We spent a bit of time on Abraham, moving into Isaac, and now Isaac into the birth of his sons, Jacob and Esau, and that's what we're going to look up, the birth of Jacob and Esau, Genesis chapter 25, and we'll pick it up from the second part of verse 19. So it's the second half of chapter 25 of Genesis. Excuse me. Right, here we go. Genesis 25, 19. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean from Paddan Aram, and sister of Laban, the Aramean. We used to own a house in Forfa. And if you go from Forfa to Kirriemuir, you pass a wee village, and it's Paddan Aram. Did you know that? We bought our shed, our garden shed, in Paddan Aram, by the way. It's in the Bible. Okay. That's just a by the way. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other. The older will serve the younger." Sorry, I'm not going to keep breaking this up, but I do want to just have a wee aside just to reassure you of something. That's not really the main part of what I want to say. But it is completely against the culture and the custom of the time for God to say what he said there, that the older will serve the younger. It was, of course, the norm that the older child was the child of the inheritance. But God, even before her children are born, informs Rebekah that two nations are in your womb, two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other. The older will serve the younger. And the aside I want to say to you is, as you read this, please be reassured that God is in control. The reason I wanted to do this aside was I read something in a commentary that I really liked. But what that passage is saying, that before these babies were born, God already knew the rivalry that was going to happen, and God already knew that against all tradition, the inheritance would be going to the younger son, who would be Jacob. God knew that. And verse 23, the two peoples from within you will be separated. So this was going to go against all tradition, and yet God knew it well before it happened. And it was going to cause terrible stress and difficulty in the family of Isaac. It was going to be a very difficult time. But God already knows it before it happens. And the reason I just want to say that is, just remind yourself that when the terrible times come, when the appalling things within your family or whatever come, we are in safe hands, because nothing takes God by surprise. And God has already informed Rebekah that this would happen even before her children were born. And the thing I wanted, the reason I wanted to take this aside was, this is what I read, because I just really liked it. It said this: you might call out to God in a sudden moment of desperation, but remember, God has had an eternity to prepare for your prayer. Isn't that wonderful? You might call out to God in a sudden moment of desperation, but remember, God has had an eternity to prepare for your prayer. So just be encouraged with that. The older will serve the younger. Pick it up again, verse 24. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment. So they named him Esau. After this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. The boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was a quiet man staying among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Bad parenting there. Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country famished. He said to Jacob, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished." That is why he was also called Edom. Jacob replied, "First, sell me your birthright." "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. "What good is a birthright to me?" But Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. Esau ate and drank and then got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. Amen. Thank you. So that was my first thing. God is in control. God had announced this even before it happened. But we're going to look at these two lovely boys, Jacob and Esau. Jacob, I can't remember. It was in an elders meeting and we said, let's look at Abraham, and we've just gone on there, Isaac. But the more I'm doing it, the more I love doing it, because these guys are a mess. And yet, Jacob is an incredible name in the Bible. Jacob, whose name later, if we go through the story of Jacob, after all his struggles, has his name changed to Israel. And Israel is the name given to the Jewish people that they still bear to this day. It is named after this guy, Jacob. And his 12 sons that Jacob goes on to have ends up being the 12 tribes of Israel that are remembered to this day. The 12 tribes of Israel named after Jacob. So he's a pretty massive character in the Bible. The whole Jewish nation is named after him. The 12 tribes of Israel are named after his sons. He's a big deal. And yet, he's unbelievably flawed. He's a mess. And you see that right at the beginning, where he loves his big butch older boy, and Rebekah loves the stay-at-home quieter one. It's not a good start. But even before that, God has said at his birth, you will see the flaw. And the flaw is symbolized at his very birth, when his older brother, older twin is born, Esau. Jacob is clinging on to his heel. Jacob is named Jacob because he held on to his brother's heel at birth. And it was like he was trying to pull his brother back and say me first. And he was given that name. Jacob means one who grasps the heel, but it also implies someone who will deceive in order to get what he wants to get ahead. And the incredible thing is that this is the start of this guy, Jacob. This is his introduction to us. The heel grabber. The one who wants to pull others back in order to get ahead. And yet God is going to take a flawed character like this and say, I will name the nation of promise after him. Does that not give you hope? That gives me hope. With all my flaws, God loves me anyway. So, the birth of Jacob, as I say, the scene is set right at his birth. Esau born first, Jacob grabbing his heel. So he's named the little heel grabber. I don't believe Isaac, when he named his son the little heel grabber, really understood the significance of what this son was going to grow up to be like. But it's figurative. It means he deceives. And it was to prove very, very accurate. He spent his life grabbing heels. Spent his life scheming, manipulating, getting what he wanted. Later on, an exasperated older brother, Esau, chapter 27, verse 36, will declare, isn't he rightly named Jacob? He has deceived me. So right from the start, there's this tension between the two. Very different brothers. I often look at that. I've got a brother, an older brother. And if I'd been fast enough, I'd have tried to grab his heel, but I could never catch him. But I've got an older brother. And you know, you're brought up by the same parents in the same home. How can you have children who are so different? How does that happen? I just don't get it. But Jacob and Esau, a prime example of that. Esau, the man's man, the outdoorsy. He'd have been in the sports team if he'd been at secondary school. A skillful hunter, a man of the open country, verse 27. And Jacob, the polar opposite, the quiet man, the stay-at-home, I'll stay with mum and I'll cook. Complete opposites. Esau, outdoorsy. Jacob, indoorsy, mummy's boy. And dad, in a way that shouldn't have happened, Isaac was drawn to the older son, and Rebecca drawn to the younger one that wanted to stay with her and cook with her. And then beginning in verse 29, there's one of these events that appears so trifling, so insignificant, and it's a reminder to us that just small events can have a big impact in our lives, because this wee incident over wanting some food ends up tearing this family completely apart. Jacob, as was his way, is at home cooking as he does. And he's cooking up a stew. And Esau, he's had a man's day. He's been out hunting. And so he comes back home. And he's so hungry. He says, I am famished. Give me some food, Jacob. And then he goes on, and you know, as children do, it suddenly gets exaggerated, and it's not just, I am famished, it's, give me food, verse 32, I'm about to die. Now Esau probably wasn't about to die. But he saw the stew cooking, and he said, quick, give me some of that red stew. And Jacob Now, this is the manipulative bit. This is the thing going on in his mind, and we'll come back to it. But Jacob, because the question is, why was he so desperate to have the birthright? And we'll come back to that. But Jacob's immediate thought is, I'll give you some stew. Sell me your birthright. Give the family's inheritance. Give me the line of that inheritance, and you can have your stew. Verse 31, sell me your birthright. Now, I am sure that as they'd grown up, and as Jacob and Esau had become aware that with that birthright, there was a promise of God. It wasn't just about the family's birthright. And we'll come back to that as well, God's promise on that birthright. But I'm sure that something had got into Jacob's head that he knew there was a promise of God over that birthright. And he was desperate for it. And he wanted it. And he knew that he wasn't entitled to it because he was the younger son. And he was going to do whatever he could do to get it. And I'm quite sure that all through their childhood and all through these hunting years, I don't believe for a minute that was the first time Jacob had said to Esau, sell me your birthright. I'm sure he'd been nagging his brother for years, trying to get his brother for years. Give me the birthright. Let me have the birthright. And then when he comes in from hunting, he does it again. But this time, because Esau has been worn down and obviously he's about to die because he's so hungry, he just goes, oh, have the birthright. Give me the food. You can have the birthright. And Esau gives up the promise in exchange for some stew. Now, as I say, coming back to it, the birthright normally would stand for two things. The birthright would mean the older son gets a double share of the inheritance and gets the headship of the family. But there was more to this birthright. In this family, the birthright stood for even more than that, because the birthright had been given first to Abraham. And Abraham, on top of a normal birthright inheritance, had been promised two other things. Firstly, he'd been promised the land of Canaan, the promised land, will be given to you. That was the promise that was over the inheritance on this family. And the second thing that was promised to him is that through this family of promise, God has promised a seed. And from that seed will come a Messiah who will bless all nations. And something I'm sure in Jacob's upbringing, as he'd heard that that promise was on his family, that you will inherit this land and God's seed will be born through this family line, that Jacob thought, I want that. I want that. But the thing is, by rights it was Esau's. And Esau, in the end, sold that promise for a mouthful of stew. Can you believe it? He ate, verse 34, and drank, and then got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. He lost everything in that moment of grabbing something that he wanted here and now. He lost everything. And yet he didn't think he'd lost anything. He turned his back on everything that God had in favor of momentary satisfaction. And I just stop us there to say, How often are we tempted to turn our back on Christ in favour of something that looks as if it will satisfy us just now? And I can promise you, whatever that thing is, it is transient, it is temporal, and it will not last. And Esau gave up a future with God in order to satisfy just for this minute. And how often are we tempted to sell out and do the same? Tempted to just lay down commitment to God in order to pursue something that we can gain in this world. And the real tragedy of Esau's life was he was willing to do it and he didn't care. Now, as I've said before, I'm sure that wasn't the first time the issue of the birthright came up. Probably the first time Esau was adamant, "I'll never give up the birthright. Don't ask me that." And the second time, "Jacob, stop asking that. It's my birthright." But as it went on and on and on, the more we don't treasure what we have with God, the more we can become immune to what God has given us. And I'm sure Esau was adamant at the beginning, but by the end, because he wasn't walking close to the promise of God and it wasn't precious to him, in the end he thought, "Oh, have the birthright, who cares?" I was thinking about, I can't remember why we were talking about it, but when we were called to first pastorate at Castle Hill Baptist, they had a manse in, I think it was the eastern part of Bears Den, but we were very conscious. You couldn't help but be conscious. When we first moved, we were, what? We were right on the flight path for Glasgow Airport. And you would sit out in the garden, and the planes were landing. And it was like you could see. You could almost see the passengers. In fact, you could see the passengers, because whenever we went on holiday to Greece and flew back into Glasgow, we could check our house was okay before we had landed, because it flew right over the roof of our house. And we used to say, "Oh, good, the house is still there. It's not burned down." Always asking for a seat at the right-hand side because you could see the house. And you used to sit in the house and you used to think, "What is this?" As the roar of the planes came in every few minutes, you're thinking, "This is unbelievable. How can anyone live under this?" Anyway, we did live under it. And I think we'd been there about 2 or 3 years and someone was visiting us. And it was a nice summer's day, and we were sitting out the back garden, and we were having lunch out the back, and we're just chatting. And the next thing, they're almost under the table going, "What is that? How do you live with that? That's unbelievable. That's like it's going to hit you." And you know, we were completely immune to it. We totally didn't hear it. 3 years later, we just didn't bother. We didn't notice it anymore. And I wonder if it was something like that with Jacob, that what he'd been told at the beginning of his life was really precious. Because he didn't treasure it as precious, it just got lost somewhere. And he didn't even notice it anymore. And in the end, his will just got worn down. And Jacob again, "Sell me your birthright and I'll give you some stew." And he despises his birthright. "Oh, have the birthright. Not bothered about those promises. I want your stew." He lived for the here and now. And there is a real tragedy in that. Please hear it. We live for the promises of God. God's promises over our eternal future. That's what we live for. And that trumps anything we can get in this world. Please remember that. That's Esau's sin, and it's a tragic sin because he despised the promises of God and didn't bother with them. It says he despised them. I don't think he despised them in the sense of he hated them, but to God he despised them because he wasn't bothered by them. And then we've got Jacob, and you'd love to say Jacob is the polar opposite, the lovely sinless one, but he isn't. He's a rogue. But he's different from Esau. And his sin is different. He does sin. And as we go on, you'll think, what's lovable about this guy? Because he's a rogue. He's a manipulator. He's a twister. He's a sinner. He even takes advantage of his brother's weakness here, and he cheats his brother. But the thing is, Esau's a sinner, Jacob's a sinner, but there is a difference between the two. And there's a difference that God sees. Though Jacob was wrong, was manipulative, was all those terrible things, and though he violated his relationship with his brother, though he was devious, though he cheated, though he stole, are we getting the picture? Though he achieved things by his own efforts, by his guile, all those things, God saw. Though you're going about this in completely the wrong way, though everything you're doing is wrong, I know why you're doing it. You're doing it because the promises of God on this family are really important to you. Jacob was not a nice person, but the difference underneath it all that God saw was he had a heart that longed for the promises of God. And he went about trying to get them for himself in all the wrong ways. And actually, if he'd trusted God, he would have got them in a beautiful way. But he went about it in all the wrong way. But the difference is, when God looked at the hearts of the boys, he saw one boy who didn't care about the promises of God. And he saw one boy who longed for the promises of God. Maybe went about it in all the wrong ways. And Jacob would pay terrible consequences for that. And we'll go through that. But he saw someone whose heart was longing for God. And I tell you what, if I'm a rogue and a rascal, and there's so much wrong with me, I think I can say that for all I get wrong, God does look at someone who longs for him and his promises in my life. And if you beat yourself up for getting it wrong so often, please remember, God does not look at the outward appearance, but he looks at your heart. And if your heart is, God, though I muck it up so often, though the way I go about it so often is wrong, you know that my heart longs for you and your promises over my life, then God is saying, I will work with you. And let's do it together. And that's what he said to Jacob. And look what he made Jacob. Well, he wants to do the same with us, rogues and rascals that we are. Amen.